Well, Joe Williams, so you come to Philadelphia, and last night there's a big hurricane, or the remnants of it. How did that affect your show?
Well, we didn't have as many people as we might have had the weather been better, I'm sure.
A lot of our listeners are going to be familiar with the songs that you've done on records, and maybe especially some of the songs you've done when you were with Basie's band. What kind of material are you singing now in your club performances? What are some of the standards and maybe some of the new songs that you continue to sing?
Well, I'm doing things from our new LP, the one that we just did with Dave Pell, called Joe Williams Takes a Prez Conference, meaning Prez Lester Young.
And we'll be things hearing that, selections from that in a couple of minutes.
Great. Yeah, things that are associated with Lester Young while he was playing on recordings with vocalists like Billie Holiday, Jimmy Rushing, and Ella Fitzgerald. And I'm doing some of those things. I'm also doing some things that were written. One thing was written by Bernard Eigner, who's a fabulous composer and a poet, a musician, and doing one of his things, Everything Must Change. And I'm doing Billy Joel's marvelous tune, Just the Way You Are. And of course, I'm singing the blues, and I'm doing the old things from the Basie book, you know, going to Chicago and All Right, Okay, You Win, and Every Day I Have the Blues. Just a potpourri of goodies, as they say.
You left the Basie Band in 61.
Right, January 61.
to be a single,
yes.
to be an independent in your career.
Yes.
How did that affect your presence on stage, do you think? Because I know when you're in a band, there's always an interplay between the band as just the band, and then there's a big flourish, and the singer comes up usually, and it's it's a big rhythmic thing in a way. The attention focuses, then maybe the singer leaves for a while, back to the band. When you're a solo, it's on you the whole time, and you've got to like carry it independently for the whole show.
What do you do unless you have exceptional instrumentalists working with you? And in this instance, I have the very best in the world, I think. The pianist is a young man named Kirk Stewart, who has played piano and sang. You know, he sings in places like the Desert Inn in Las Vegas, great hotels all around the country, the Executive House in Chicago. And he also has worked with people like Sarah Vaughan, where he recorded with her from the Tivoli in Copenhagen, Denmark. And he's also played and sung and conducted for Julie London in her marvelous presentations around the country as well. And right now he's teaching at Howard University. And he took 42 young people over to Europe this year. 42 people from his school, and they put on Raisin in the Sun, the stage play. And he is currently in consultation with people now to conduct a Broadway play. Well, people of this caliber, I mean, you can put them there for 15 minutes, and the audience is absolutely captured. Our bassist is Keeter Betts, and Keeter Betts has been with Ella Fitzgerald now for some 16 years or so. He was on the telethon with her, the Jerry Lewis telethon on Saturday. What was it? Sunday night they started it. Sunday.
I don't recall, yeah.
They started it Sunday. That's right. It went Sunday from 6 o'clock Sunday through 6 o'clock on Monday from Las Vegas, and he was just working with her there, and came here to work with us here at the Safari Bush, and you have instrumentalists of this quality working with you. You can put on a bass, a contrabass, you know, the big bass fiddle thing for about 10 minutes, and people will be thoroughly entertained with the caliber of musicians that you have with you. And then there's interplay with him and the drums. Warren Shadd, who is also a fine pianist. You see him playing drums and you say, my, what a fine drummer. And he can sit down. He was one of Kirk's students and just got his degree from Howard University and played with people like Lionel Hampton, you know, and Kenny Burrell. So you don't really have, what you do have when you have a small combo is more flexibility,
mm-hmm.
much more flexibility than you do when you are with the big band, because then you must stay within the framework of the prepared musical arrangement when you are with the big band. It gives you a great deal more freedom.
I know a lot of women singers, when they're performing, try to be very sensual on the stage, wearing maybe a very revealing, sensual dress or something. Do you feel that you play the part of the ladies' man on stage, or that's something you do, or something that you're supposed to do when you're up on stage and when you're a male singer of your stature?
I think each one has to take that kind of presentation to his own depth and perception. And there's no not by design does one become sensual. I think either you are or you are not. You know, I guess people are the only ones that are unable, maybe. We were talking earlier today. I was on a television show, and a former priest was on, a young man who has left the priesthood now and is married and is still feels as though he is a good Catholic, but not bound by the restrictions, you see, of the Pope or of some other celibate person, because he feels as though he can relate better to people if he is at least a people person.
Mm-hmm.
And in his conversation about his book, I think it's, what's his name, Kavanaugh, isn't it? Something like that, a fellow that has written a book. And in his conversation, one word came through, seduction. And what you're talking about is seduction when you say a person is sensual. And we have to be able to, as human beings, we have to be able to read when we are being seduced and when we are not.
Mm-hmm.
And so each one does that to his own depth and perception. And I must say that many times, of course, things are misread. People who just want to be friends and no more and don't really mean to be physically seductive are misread. And you have to distinguish the difference between the two, a gesture of warmth or just touching. And with music, you are touching, you see. You do touch responsive chords in people.
When you first joined the Basie Band in, I guess it was the 55.
Mid-50s, yeah.
There's a big tradition of great singers that you were walking into with that band, Billie Holiday, Helen Humes, Jimmy Rushing.
Yes.
Did you feel that you had to somehow fit into this tradition in a very direct way? Did you have to, like, stake out your territory and immediately decide what your style was and in what way you were going to be different from them?
Well, the safest way to establish yourself is to bring to the organization that you were working with songs that had not been performed by the other singers who had preceded you. And that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And continued to do so for the first 4.5 to 5 years that I was there before I would finally sing something that Jimmy Rushing had sung.
Many of the musicians who were in the Basie Band at the time that you were in it were different than the musicians who were there in the 30s when some of the other singers I mentioned were singing with the band.
Freddie Green was the only one, the guitarist was the only one that was there, and of course Count Basie.
How did the arrangements get worked out between you and
the arrangers?
You did work with the arrangers?
Yes, I worked with Ernie Wilkins and with Frank Foster and Thad Jones and Edgar Sampson and all of the people that did arrangements for the orchestra. I worked with the arrangers all the time.
Who were your favorite soloists at that time, who you particularly liked to have solo when you were singing?
I think all of the fellows used impeccably good taste, you know. The musicians are a very, very sensitive group. I mean, I refer to them as those that were, they are the seekers of harmony rather than discord, you know. And I can't think of any of the fellows who didn't contribute. I mean, they always managed to contribute, not get in the way, just to contribute another facet, another harmonic concept that would lend itself to making the overall presentation a great whole.
I think your first big hit with Basie was Every Day.
Our first recording. Yes.
Did that typecast you in any way? Do you feel as a blues singer, were you obliged to sing only the blues when you went up for a show?
No. I mean, you don't do that. The only time I think you have to do one thing, if you only do one thing well. But if you're able to do other things and to do them well and touch an audience, you know, a listening audience, that is, then you can broaden your field, broaden your scope, so to speak.
Sometimes people have expectations that you're going to be exactly like you are on a record and not stray from that at all. I think it's different in jazz, for instance, than in rock and roll. You go to a rock and roll concert, and people, I think, want the instrumentalist to play the same solo that they play on the record. I think a jazz audience goes expecting to hear improvisation, so it's different in that respect. But still, I should think it's easy for people to have expectations of what material you sing when you go to a show.
I think it would be nice if you just go to a rock concert and hear.
Yeah.
Really. I'd like to hear some of these people, I mean, with real dynamics, you know. Or I would say if there was a power failure, then I'd like to hear their performance. If there was a power failure, would they be able to perform then?
When you were singing with Basie in the 50s, I'd imagine you were all on the road together a lot.
Yes, we were.
Now, I've heard stories about big bands on the road in the 30s and the 40s when it was on the bus.
Driving
around the country. Was it the bus in the 50s or were you into planes then?
Some planes, but a lot of the travel was on bus, which was like a home away from home for us because everyone had his own space and no one violated another's space.
How much space could you have on a bus?
Enough to stretch out and go to sleep. Or to open a can of tuna and have a meal, or to have some fruit, you know. And by the time I joined the band, I mean, then we had washrooms aboard the buses most of the time, anyway. And it was the schedules were worked out reasonably well, so that there were no big jumps. If there were, they were few and far between, and. It was all a lot of fun because that is when the wit and the minds of the group, it seems just at the lowest ebb, someone will come up with something that will spark you and cause everyone to be interested and not notice the miles going by.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Okay, my guest is Joe Williams, if you're just joining us. Have you ever felt that you've had to sacrifice having a stable home and family? I don't know anything about your personal life, in order to live the life of a singer who is so frequently on the road, and not only on the road in the States, but touring other countries. I believe you're going to Africa soon.
Yes, the State Department sending us to Africa. Last year it was to Afghanistan and India, Egypt and Turkey and Pakistan for 5 weeks with Clark Terry. I will, I guess, after the African tour, I will have not been to South America and to China. And I can't think of anything that I... Can you imagine the people in the world, I mean, who've maybe never even been outside of their hometown, don't get to see any of the world or to visit with, to share the culture of other countries, to eat other food, and to see the art and to see the structure and to be a part of a world that we all were born to. And it's a shame that we couldn't very peaceably visit, you know. And I feel I've been privileged, you know, very, very privileged to be gifted as a performing artist, and to be able to go places and do things. My wife is traveling. You spoke about a stable home life. We have a happy home life. As my wife says, she refers to me as Sir. She says, well, life with Sir is anything but dull.
You know, she travel with you sometimes?
Yes, whenever she wishes to. We were just in Los Angeles for 2 weeks. We were in New York for a month, and she's going to Africa, but not with me. She and a girlfriend are going to Africa on their own, and they're going to visit Kenya and a few other places, you know, the game preserves and what have you, and take pictures, because she's very much involved, well, at least for 6 years as vice president and then president and secretary for 2 years each for the Humane Society for Clark County in Las Vegas, Nevada, where we live. And she's very involved with animals worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, she's very, very busy on her own. And she's going to Africa on her own and then going to meet me in New York for 2 weeks in November when I'll be there and we'll see some shows together and everything.
See each other for a while, yeah.
Oh, no, no, no. Then we go home. I go home and I'll be off for the rest of the year. I usually take about 2 or 3 months a year off.
How do these State Department tours work? Are you supposed to be an official emissary of the United States when you're performing?
We are.
What does that mean politically? Does it have any real political meaning in any sense, one way or another, for better or for worse?
I think most of the time when musicians go, musicians and entertainers are sent more or less to show that there's something besides ugly Americans, really. Because we're welcomed always as performing artists first. And when you are looked upon as a very special person, it behooves you to at least try to live up to the spiritual thought that people have of you. And if you do, if you try to live up to what they think of you, then they'll come down to you.
Is there anything that
you know? You notice I said come down to you, because what I'm speaking about here is most Americans don't speak many languages, you know, and you're visiting places where the languages and the culture is so different from ours here, and where they are by comparison disadvantaged, you know, according to our standards of living. And so we must come up to them, to their strength. We must come up to them, and they think that we are something very, very special. So we have to at least try to be very, very special. I find that good manners and respect will get you into many places that money won't even open the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're talking about traveling through through different countries. Let's talk a little bit about some of the different states in this country that you've played. You grew up in Chicago.
Yes.
A place that has a very strong reputation for the blues. Are there cities now where you think they're like more tuned into the blues than other cities are? Sometimes I think that musically things are getting more homogenized throughout this country, and sometimes I think, no, there's still a pretty strong sense of regionalism musically. What do you think?
I think when the music is well done and well presented, you don't have any problem in any part of the country. It's just that the enthusiasm seems to be greater anywhere outside of the continental United States. And maybe that's because of the saturation that you get here with either country and Western or what is considered pop music here in this country. But outside the continental United States, it seems that almost everyone is aware. More people are aware of you. They know what you've done, and they also learn to wait and see what you're going to present next, because you've been coming up. Your track record shows that you keep coming up with something else other than the recorded thing. People don't come to just hear your recorded things when they come to see you. They come to see what you have to present, mm-hmm. because they know that you are always adding to your repertoire and expanding your repertoire, and they remark about the fact that, wow, it's always nice to come and see you because you're always full of surprises. And they like that. They look forward to it, to being entertained that way.
How do you treat a song when you decide you're going to do a tune and you're going to add that to your repertoire? Do you just sing it and do it as it naturally emerges, or do you sit down and really think about how you want to structure the song in your presentation?
I think you hear it in your mind actually before you do it. And you hear whether or not, I think you're first convinced of the song and the content of it in your own mind, and then you're able to convey it. That's the best way to do it, I think, anyway. You must hear it first. Most musicians, they hear what they do before they actually do it. They hear it first, which is why maybe some of us enjoy it so much. And those that don't enjoy their work so much, they say, oh, Christ, I'm going to quit, because they're no longer enjoying it, and it's very difficult. It's like having a job then,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who are some of the musicians or singers who have most inspired you?
Oh, my gosh. I think years ago, Miss Ethel Waters, when she was singing popular work rather than her spiritual work.
1930s work?
Yes. Because she sang with such great feeling.
Great phrasing also.
Yes. Oh, marvelous phrasing. Good diction.
Yeah, yeah.
And the feeling There was always a warmth, a whimsy, a vulnerability in the sound. And she inspired me a great deal.
I noticed the diction in your singing, too, the diction and the phrasing. You really hear the words. You hear them as words and as lyrics and music.
Thank you, Terry.
No, sure. Is that a conscious thing, or is that just the way you sing?
I think it's a natural thing.
Mm-hmm.
Quite naturally, because I didn't sing the blues until I heard the singer. I heard Joe Turner. And I could understand the words, most of them, you know. And I began to feel what he was saying. Now, many of the other singers, many of the other blues singers, the itinerant blues singers that I used to hear years ago, I couldn't quite understand their lyric because they were country, what we call country blues singers. And where I was educated in Chicago, Illinois, and every school I attended was predominantly white, I couldn't pick up the dialect and the sound of the words, and I had to guess a great deal at what they were saying when I did start to listen to them. And even today, brunch, that's what it was. But I have to study it and listen to it again and again to actually hear all that is being said, because some of it sounded like monosyllables, you know, and half-finished words and things like that. And I think having read some of Paul Laurence Dunbar helped me a great deal in that area.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's get back to talking about some of the people who've musically really excited or inspired you.
Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington, I mean, it's great dignity, the sophistication, and yet at one point in his career in the 30s, I think, in the 20s, they had things like Duke Ellington on recording, Duke Ellington and his jungle music.
Right.
You know, and yet it had to be possibly the most sophisticated jungle I think that I ever heard in my life. He wrote things like Harlem Airshaft, you know, and Sepia Panorama. People talk about Black being beautiful. He wrote Black Beauty in the 30s, I think it was, you know, and Sepia Panorama and Ebony Rhapsody and things like that. He did this years, eons before people. He's been in orbit, for God's sakes, for over 40 years before they finally decided that black was beautiful. They asked him on his 70th birthday, could we expect his music to make some expression in there? He says, I thought I made a statement about that some time ago. Black, brown, and beige, you know. He had done that, you know.
Any other people who you'd like to mention?
Right now?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Just the young men I mentioned before, Keita Betts and Kirk Stewart. And Warren Shad, our group that are working with us over at the Safari Bush over in the Cheltenham Shopping Center, right in back of Gimbel's. We're having a ball over there with the music, really. And audiences. Also, Pieces of Dreams are there, too.
Oh, they're a good group. I've
they're
seen
a marvelous
them.
Young group.
They're all
group,
about
you know,
14, 15, tomorrows. 16 years old.
There are our tomorrows right there again.
You were real young when you started. You were, what, 17 when you first started singing professionally?
Yes, yes.
Can I just ask you briefly to tell us what that was like being a 17-year-old, being below drinking age and probably singing in clubs?
Very romantic.
Was it?
Awfully romantic. The lights were romantic. The sound was romantic. The feeling was very romantic. The world of romance of a youngster who had never really experienced it, but in his imagination, it was wilder and more intense maybe than it really is, you know, when you get down to it. And yet, it was a dream world, I think, for any young man, especially when you grew up playing soccer, handball, baseball, football, tennis, and, you know, things like that, and you're into sports and one of the fellas in the whole bit, and mostly thinking that, oh, gosh, I'll probably never have a girlfriend or anything like that because, I mean, who would want to be bothered with me? I had a very, very, I had such a low opinion of myself, you know, per se.
That's hard to imagine.
But no, really.
But
really.
I believe
I felt I was terribly unattractive. Well, I mean, I could dance. I was the best dancer in our group, yes. But, I mean, I didn't expect anything, you know, more than to hold a girl in my arms. But to have, like, a girl friend, per se, that kind of thing, you know, someone that wanted to kiss me, and I didn't know there was anything more, you know.
Right.
I didn't. Oh, I was, well, I mean, nobody told me, so I didn't know. You know, my mother just told me to be careful of the ones that were hot. So I didn't, and I said, yes, ma'am, and I didn't know what the hell she was talking about, you know.
Well, I bet when you sing now that a lot of people project all kinds of fantasies onto you. Now I'm sure for many years you've been a figure of romantic yes. fantasy for many
yes.
people.
Yes.
How do you handle that?
Well, I realize that what I do comes through me rather than I'm just the vehicle through which this thing comes. And if it makes people more aware of their own sensuality, then it has succeeded. Because that is the, I think that is the ultimate anyway. If one is aware, is made more aware of their own sensuality, you know, then I think, and that means that men and women, which is one of the reasons why I think men come to see me as well as women, and bring their women to see me and what have you. And being in it as long as I have, for over 40 years now, you must understand. Now the sons and daughters, and they come to see me and talk about it. Just last night, someone asked for something from A Man Ain't Supposed to Cry, which I recorded in 1957. And I said, my gosh, you mean there are people here that want to hear that? And they said, yes. And I said, well, I know the people, I've had men to walk up to me and put a baby in my arms and said, well, this one is yours. You made this one. I had nothing to do with it, you know, because of those recordings. And when I said that, a young girl sitting in the audience raised her hand to say, I am one of those, you know. So it's now, you get generations. It's a wonderful feeling. I've had people to come to me and say, a fellow to say, when I heard you sing Stardust in the Regal Theater, my girl kissed me for the first time. We're now married and we're going to have our first child. You know, things like that. I've had people who are over 40 to come and stand by the men's room until I come out. I saw them when I went in, and they'd stand there, and they'd hold hands, and they'd look at each other, and they'd say, we call your recordings music to hold families together.
Well, that almost makes you very happy.
Of course it does.
Course,
it makes
yeah.
you feel warm all over. And I've always been able to relate to that. If I see a couple in the street, and they're very much in love with each other, and it's obvious, you know, I feel good.
Uh-huh.
You see a family together. And you see real true concern for just them. They have their own little bubble, man, and they go down the street, you know, or on the beach or wherever they happen to be. And there's real caring there. I get a glow on. Reflection of we're reflections of each other anyway. My wife has a word for it. She says kindred spirits. Either you are or you are not a kindred spirit.